This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Everybody listen up then. This is important. Okay, no one wants to be left on McNabb's Island, do they? Yes or no? Okay, what's the most important thing? Remember to come back and get the boat.
Every year, the Friends of McNabb Society organizes a massive volunteer beach cleanup. About 170 volunteers get ferried out to McNabb's Island in the middle of Halifax Harbor to help get rid of some of the debris and garbage that accumulates on McNabb's beaches every year.
One thing I should mention, too, is about the tides, because the tide is rising, so that means that you need to make sure you leave all your garbage bags well above the high water mark. And as far as things to pick up, leave all wood and anything that's organic on the beach, but pick up everything else. There'd be lots of plastic, there'd be lots of Tim Hortons cups, lots of old fishing gear, plastic bags, all kinds of plastic junk.
Welcome to the third episode of The Coastal Citizen, where we explore the issues, challenges, and opportunities of life on the coast. I'm your host, Erica Butler. The vastness of the ocean has made it a natural go-to spot for getting rid of what we don't want. But since the advent of plastic more than 50 years ago, even the seas might be reaching a saturation point. In this episode of The Coastal Citizen, we look at why and how we treat the ocean like a garbage dump, how it's affecting us, and what we're doing to clean it up. You wouldn't believe how many plastic items you can find in a small stretch of beach. Everything from toothpaste caps to plastic straws to tampon applicators. Oh, so many tampon applicators. Our first stop on this episode of The Coastal Citizen is McNabb's Island, where we'll meet some of the folks who make an effort to clean it up every year.
Hello in here.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
What kind of stuff have you picked up today?
Mostly bottle, rope, styrofoam. A lot of styrofoam.
Yeah.
Anything that'll float.
Yeah. Have you noticed changes over the years that you've been...
Yes, I have.
Yeah, what sort of changes?
The first year I was here, the pile we had was over my head. And it's gone down quite a bit now.
What do you think accounts for that?
People doing this every year.
So it's slowly reducing the amount that's staying on the island.
Right. We're getting a lot of the big stuff. Now it's more a lot of small stuff that keeps blowing in.
My name is Jonathan Cusick. My background is marine biology.
Oh, great.
So I've spent a lot of time in ocean and ocean issues and stuff. And but this is the macro stuff that we're seeing on the beaches, right? I mean, it's trash you can actually visibly see, which is fantastic. Don't get me wrong. It's fantastic to clean this stuff up because it eventually breaks down anyways. That's probably the biggest problem is that they're the breakdown, and that's where you're talking about the big gyres out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
A lot of that's just micro. You don't see it at this level. So as these plastics break down, they never really degrade down to nothing. They just degrade down to smaller and smaller molecules, and they get uptaken by a lot of living creatures. And a lot of living creatures and the fish take it as part of their things, and we end up eating our own plastic because we fish that. We eat the tuna, right? Eventually gets into the tuna. So all this stuff that we're taking off the beaches is important because it'll eventually end up out there anyways, and they eventually end up eating it. So either we take it off and put it in the dump now, or we end up eating it.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a huge issue, I think, for... At least for these kids, right? That's what I'm worried about, is the kids, eventually.
It's interesting, because you can see, I guess, lots of different degrees of degradation in the plastic.
Exactly.
You can pick up.
Yep, and it, very much so. And get along the beach, they get broken up in the wave action, and a lot of the high-energy beaches will break it up into little bits, and eventually it'll get into the ocean, or get uptaken by things along the beach, fish along the coast, all that kind of stuff. So if society makes a big push... And I think some people are kind of aware of it, but you'd be surprised how things eventually get down to the coast and get incorporated into the actual... Everything ends up in the ocean. Everything ends up in the ocean. So anything you put on land eventually is going to end up there somehow. Either broken down, getting down through into the streams, or as a piece of plastic actually floating out in the river. It happens. So you've got to make the conscious effort, no matter where you live, of actually trying to put that in a safe place where you can actually put it away, or Better yet, let's get rid of plastic altogether and go back to glass and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Plastics do have an advantage.
Right, yeah. Yeah. You can safely leave the glass on the beach here and it'll...
And it breaks down. You get these beautiful things, and eventually glass is sand, mm-hmm. right? It's just a different type of silicon that actually puts it together. But plastics, totally different ballgame. So... And yeah, you drop a bottle in the store and it's a plastic bottle, it won't break. It's great, right? But then again, I mean, there's a cost to everything, right? So, yeah.
I've been a member of the Friends of McNabb's for going on 10 years, I think. And they do the cleanup every year. And I started helping them sort of organize a portion of it about 5 years ago.
Over the years that you've been doing it, have you noticed a change in what kind of garbage you're seeing on the coast, or how much garbage you're seeing?
I haven't noticed a huge change. I mean, there seems to always be garbage here. I actually don't attribute that to anything more than the ocean has a tendency to collect these things, and it does end up here because this is like the filter for the Halifax Harbor. So I think no matter how much we try, there's always going to be stuff washing up here. It's the same as every coastal beach, really. So it just needs to be cleaned up every year. You know, it's just something that's going to happen. There's too much built up in the oceans in general, and, you know, the way it moves is just always going to collect here no matter what. There's tons on the ocean floor everywhere, right? So I don't blame it on any one person or industry or thing. That's just me. It's everyone. It's everything. It's how we live. It's how careless we all are in general about garbage.
One of the things I couldn't help noticing on my journey around McNabb's was the preponderance of plastic tampon applicators. Everywhere I went, I found dozens of these colorful plastic bullets in the sand, rocks, and natural debris of the beach. I came across Patrick McInnes, another volunteer who had made the same observations.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
Sure, go ahead.
So what kind of stuff did you find today?
Well, we got a separate bag. That's our perennial favorite there, the tampon applicators.
Wow, you separate them.
Well, I just do out of curiosity, because I know that we tend to pick up a lot of them. Not as many this year as there have been in past years. Last year, for some reason, I don't know why, we kept finding them in groups of five. But it's down this year, which I think is a good sign. And as for this stuff, that does come from our sewage system. I did ask a friend who deals with that, and he said it's precisely because it's plastic.
Yeah.
Their system is used to dealing with heavy solids sinking to the bottom, whereas this stuff tends to float, gets missed by the skimmers, gets flushed out into the system, which means not everything we put back into the ocean is, after being treated, is necessarily clean.
Oh, really? So yeah. You think that a lot of these tampon applicators are like new? Or I was just postulating that maybe they're just decades old.
Oh, and you can have that as well, and you are going to have that because they're floating out there.
Yeah.
It can take a while for it to come back, but you've got some that are obviously like new.
Yeah, they don't look. Some don't look very weathered at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, let you get back to it.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Back at home, I did a little web research on the perennial problem of the plastic tampon applicator. It turns out they are the bane of beaches everywhere, lovingly dubbed beach whistles by those who clean them up. But why are they so noticeable? When I really think about it, I'm sure I gathered more plastic bottle caps on McNabb's than I did tampon applicators. But the tampon applicators somehow stood out. Could it be because they were menstrual products? Could it be because they were just so beautiful? All those pretty colors in the sand? Or could it be because I didn't know how they got there? Where did they come from? It might have seemed reasonable to have a harbor full of plastic tampon applicators back when all of our sewage flowed directly into it. Yes, that's right. Up until as recently as 2009, Halifax toilets flushed into the harbor. But since then, we treat our sewage. The harbor is beautiful again. The murky sludge is gone, and you can even see marine life flourishing in the water as you walk along the waterfront. If Patrick McInnes was right, then the scourge of tampon applicators was actually coming from our sewage system. So I called up Halifax Water, the utility that runs Halifax's wastewater system. The official line from Halifax Water is no. Tampon applicators are not escaping the system, because even the overflow chambers are equipped with screens to help keep the floatables out of the harbor. They offered me a trip down to see a sewage pumping station at work, and lucky me, I went on one of the rainiest days of the summer.
Hi, I'm Lewis Stewart. I'm a work supervisor with Halifax Water. So right now, because of the rain, we're into some pretty high flows coming through here right now. So this is the rack. There's a 3-inch spacing, roughly, between the bars. So anything smaller than 3 inches, 2.5 to 3 inches, is permitted to go through, and it goes right by here. So what Clinton's going to do now is he's going to break some debris up. So what you're seeing right here is the kind of debris we're getting. It's hard sometimes when you look at it. I mean, we don't physically inspect this stuff to see exactly what it is all the time, right? But you can identify certain products that we're getting constantly. And we tend to blame a lot of things on feminine hygiene products, but it's not totally that. People flush diapers down toilets. People flush rags and whatever else that they can't get rid of quickly in their own home, they'll flush it down the toilet.
Condom?
Yep, that's we see a lot of those.
A Snickers wrapper?
That probably came through the storm side of the system,
yeah,
right? So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a fair amount of plastic that you can see is just street garbage.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Gets in through the catch pits, and once it comes in through the catch basins around the city, then it's in our system.
Lewis Stewart tells me that every day workers rake out about 30 to 40 pounds of debris from this pumping station, located in an older part of Halifax that has a combined sewer system. Separated sewers keep rainwater and sewage separate, making it much easier to handle and treat sewage. But combined sewers mix it all together, which means they pick up all kinds of garbage, like Snickers wrappers, along the way. And their flows during rainstorms are often too much to handle. The combined system is essentially prone to flooding, and so there are overflows worked into the system. A combined sewer overflow is basically a big chamber that empties into the harbor. The chamber allows some of the heavy solids of sewage to settle so they won't all flow out into the harbor, and screens are in place to catch all the floatables. If a CSO is working properly, tampon applicators and Snickers wrappers won't get out. Instead, they'll be caught in the screens of the CSO chamber. Which brings me to the real question I had for Lewis Stewart.
So one of the questions I'm sort of trying to answer is it possible for tampon applicators to get out, once they're in the sanitary sewer system, to get out into the harbor anymore?
Yes. We have in our screening chambers, we have, as a built-in safety, we have a hydraulic relief point. So basically that if there's that much flow that comes through and the levels in the screening chambers reach this hydraulic relief point, then all the floatables will actually go over that weir and out into the harbor. We definitely absolutely try to avoid that. That is a safety feature that's built into all of our CSO chambers, but it does happen. And so to that end, we definitely try to be more diligent and get those floatables off of the surfaces in the CSO chambers so that if it does go into a hydraulic relief, those floatables don't get out.
Okay. So that would be basically in a really extreme weather event, like a lot of rain really quick.
Yes. And lately we've been having like 2 or 3 of those a year, right, where we get trounced on or we get inundated with a huge amount of rain in a short period of time, and that puts our CSO chambers into a hydraulic relief position, and at that point floatables can get out over the weir and can get into the harbor.
So which might happen a couple 2 to 3 times a year, depending.
We definitely try to skim the surface of the CSO chambers. We bring vac trucks in and we try to vacuum off the surface so that if in the event that we do get that severe rain, then it's very minimal what should get out.
So it turns out that Patrick McInnes is right. Floatables do get into the harbor, but only a few times a year, when enough rain comes fast enough to cause an overflow on the overflow.
We're talking two different types of overflows.
Yeah.
One is completely a screened overflow, and that would happen during pretty much every major rain event. So when we get up around 30 to 40 millimeters of rain, we're going to go into overflow, but those are completely screened overflows.
Right.
When we get up to the 80 plus rainfalls that are at a short period of time, then we're going into hydraulic relief, and that's when the floatables can possibly get out into the harbor.
It doesn't smell as bad as I thought it would here.
Yeah, it's I can't smell it anyway because my nose is dead. So.
All right, and I suppose you've developed an immunity to the smell.
Yeah, I'm used to it. We do get fresh air coming through in that, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, they must have spent a little bit on the ventilation system.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Awesome.
You're listening to The Coastal Citizen. It's estimated that 60 to 90% of ocean trash is plastic. Much of it you can see, like on the beaches of McNabb's Island, or caught in the screens of our sewer systems. But the frightening reality is that most of it you can't. You will hear the term microplastics more and more in the coming years. Scientists are just beginning to figure out the scope and dangers of our microscopic plastic problem. Last spring, two Dalhousie University students joined this burgeoning field with studies looking at microplastics in and around Halifax Harbor. Here's Olivia Paytich and Elise Mathelon. I started out asking Elise to explain a bit about what microplastics are.
Microplastics are plastics that are less than a millimeter in their size. They come from a variety of sources. There are some microplastics that are made in microplastic form initially, and they are used in like cement fillers and exfoliating cleaning soaps and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then there's also microplastics that come from large plastic items, just like degraded macro plastic debris, mm-hmm. That just sheds off microplastics. And a big source of microplastics is from synthetic clothing fibers, so polyester and acrylic and nylon. When you wash your clothes, they all release microplastics from the big clothing garments.
Mm-hmm. That was the one that most saddened me, because I really like polar fleece, you know.
Same,
it's
yeah.
Like it's so practical and useful, but yeah, I guess yeah. I'm imagining when every time I wash a polar fleece sweater, it's shedding into that water all kinds of, so they're tiny little fibers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and fleece is actually like
the worst.
Yeah, it sheds the most microplastics of all the plastic garments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How small is the micro in microplastics? Like, what size are we talking about?
It depends. Some of the fibers you can, like, they're in my lab, I left like a petri dish out overnight of water, and then when I went back in the morning, I saw that there was tiny fibers that had settled in. And kind of when you leave a glass of water like on your bedside table, and you see there's like little things on the surface of your water, like that's from the dust. So it's like they're circulating the air. So some of them you can see, but they can also be super small, like especially if they have been in the ocean and like have fragmented further, mm-hmm. they can be micrometers in length. And even smaller in diameter. So,
what are each of your the specific projects that you're studying right now?
Well, I was focusing on bottom sediments in the harbor. So I had like sediment cores that I was looking at, just the surface of them. And then I took water samples, like surface water samples from the harbor, as well as wild mussels from the harbor. And I dissected just the stomach out of the mussels and then looked at the microplastic content in the individual stomachs.
So what were the results?
There's microplastics everywhere. Mm-hmm. The sediment definitely had the highest concentration of microplastics, especially because I was looking at sediment cores. So it kind of represents the long-term accumulation. And then the water samples that I were looking at had a lot of microplastics in them, however, a lot less than the sediment, because the water is constantly circulating. Mm-hmm. And because it's circulating, microplastics aren't really localized in an area when they're taken from the surface. So you kind of need to do like time series sampling in order to get like a actual microplastic concentration on the water instead of just like the one sample, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. So it kind of just gave like a little glimpse into what was on the surface of the water. And then the mussels, yeah, they had similar concentrations to what I found in the water, which we kind of expected. They were a little higher, again, because the mussels, the microplastics will accumulate in the mussels because it's not the type of thing that their bodies are used to processing, so they might get like balled up and aren't excreted,
right.
Essentially.
Yeah. They can ingest, but they can't digest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you also, did you compare what you found with wild mussels with farmed mussels as well?
That's what I did.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was looking more on the outskirts of Halifax Harbor, like at Rainbow Haven Beach and McCormick's Beach, and I was looking at sediment samples as well as wild mussels from those locations. And so I dissected the entire mussel, and I also bought mussels from the superstore that were coming from an aquaculture site, and I did the same process, like dissected those and processed them and counted microplastics. And I found, I was counting hundreds of microplastics in all these mussels. And I was finding double the amount of microplastic in the farm mussels compared to the wild ones.
So that's disturbing.
Yeah.
You would think that if they're in a, you know, more controlled environment, they might have less exposure to microplastics. But so where, what's the theory on why the farm mussels are having a higher concentration?
Well, the theory is that they're farmed on polypropylene plastic lines. So polypropylene, I don't know, most people that have interacted with it know that it sheds tons of little microplastic fibers just by rubbing it in your hands. So when it's in the ocean, it's subject to lots of movement and mechanical degradation, so right into the siphons of the mussels. Mm-hmm. So they're just eating it directly from where they're being grown on. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the major contributor for why it has more plastics in it.
You were looking at sediment samples in different locations. You know, a layman might think, oh, Halifax Harbor would probably have more. Especially since, you know, we've been dumping our raw sewage in here for ages. And if, you know, even our treated sewage probably has tons of microplastics in it, if, you know, wash water and all that kind of thing. Because we're obviously not treating for microplastics. So did you find, was there big differences between the sediment samples between your two research projects? Did you compare them?
There were. I mean, she had some, her sediment samples, she could barely even count the microplastics on them because they were so heavily contaminated, whereas I could.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The, the biggest issue that I had with my samples was that there was a really, really high abundance of microspheres, which are different than fibers. Microspheres are ones that are manufactured in microscopic form and that are added to cleaners and exfoliants and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of them. And I think, again, because I was looking at a sediment core, the range of spheres that I saw was just crazy. Like there was very, very small ones to ones that I could see without a microscope, just like on the edge of the filter. And I think that's just because the 5 centimeters that I was looking at basically represented like 20 years of accumulation. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, you know, the background of all of the different microplastics that have entered the harbor since, you know, however long ago, the, you know, 20 plus years was it has been.
Contaminants leach onto these plastics, microplastics in the water, because they're hydrophobic. They don't like, contaminants want to latch onto things that are not water.
Right.
So do plastics. So they attract each other. So plastics are actually, could be used as a way to measure contaminants in water, which also makes them more dangerous when things eat them, because they can be also eating lots of contaminants.
Gosh. We have a microplastics problem, I guess. I mean, if you're finding more than you can count in a sample in the Halifax Harbor, that's obviously too many. Mm-hmm. What kind of effects, you know, do you suppose might be, you know, might we see from all this?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that, like, so we were looking at mussels, which are bottom of the food chain. So there's a chance of, like, biomagnification. So as, you know, bigger things higher up on the food chain eat things lower down, the microplastics could be transferred to them. Ultimately, we're being at the top. But there's not really a lot of research that has gone into the physiological effects of microplastics on organisms. I mean, there was one study that looked at, they fed microplastics to mussels, and they found that these spheres went from their gut into their circulatory system, into their blood within, was it like 3 days?
3 days, yeah.
Yeah, and then persisted there for 12 days.
And 48.
48 days.
Yeah.
Until they started to see a decrease. So, you know, they're not just staying in their stomach, but they're, you know, getting stored in their, in other parts of their body.
Wow.
So,
what's next in terms of study in this regard? I mean, what do you think are the key areas or the key questions that we should be answering?
There needs to be a comprehensive study on how microplastic, different types of microplastics interact with different types of contaminants, because they all interact differently. One contaminant acts differently on one type of plastic compared to another contaminant. So I think there needs to be an assessment of like the most prominent contaminants in the environment and the most prominent microplastics in the environments, see how they interact and see how they interact within organisms. Like when organisms eat contaminated plastics, are the contaminants getting leached out into the bodies of these organisms, or are they just passing through? Mm-hmm. Like these are types of studies that need to be done to determine how much damage is being caused by microplastics. Mm-hmm. And also, microplastics aren't regulated in the seafood industry. Obviously, I like counted hundreds in these farmed mussels that are sold in the store. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be some attention on microplastics in the aquaculture industry, because mm-hmm. nobody wants to be eating plastics mm-hmm. and they just mm-hmm. don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess there's also going to need to be some attention on, you know, on our manufacturing mm-hmm. side of the world for, you know, non-food related, mm-hmm. just in terms of what they're putting out there.
Of course, mm-hmm. yeah.
And what we're buying and mm-hmm. washing yes. our faces with.
Right.
And yeah.
Because
yeah.
it went from, you know, them using sand and salt and like natural exfoliants and natural products as these like scrubbers. But it's, you know, it's the quick and easy way to make the most money. So really it's, you know, if, kind of starts with the consumer, just like everything, you know, in order to like reduce how many microplastics you're putting into the ocean, you gotta have to think about things when you're buying them, you know, look on the labels, see if there's polyethyl something, because mm-hmm. most likely that's plastic.
I think the main thing you can do about microplastics is just be aware of the products you're using in your everyday life, because that's where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. They're coming from our clothes, they're coming from face washes, they're coming from packaging of our food products.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I just try to be aware and conscious about how much plastic I'm purchasing when I do my grocery shop and things like that. And packaging companies aren't changing tomorrow. So it's about just individually making choices to mm-hmm. see what results you want in the future.
Right. Individuals
mm-hmm. yeah.
can sometimes add up to a critical mass. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Elise Mathelon and Olivia Pejtich. Best of luck with your research.
Thanks,
you. Erica.
All right.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of The Coastal Citizen. Next week, we begin our exploration into the future of fish with a look at aquaculture issues on the Atlantic coast. The Coastal Citizen is produced at CKDU-FM in Halifax with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I've been your host, Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.